process looks to us as though it's just circling, when in fact a different frame of reference would suggest it's in free fall, trying to hit the Earth and missing perpetually.
Yeah, I think I rest my case, if I can say that. I agree with you. There is something like a negative mass, if you would like to say something about it.
Well, I would tend to dispute that. There are things like antiparticles. And unfortunately, if you read a lot of Stephen Hawking's, there must be at least eight editions of that book that made him millions and millions of dollars. And he tried to explain Hawking's radiation in a simplified manner that made no sense to either physicists or people who regularly read physics books. And one of them was the idea of spontaneous creation of paired particle and antiparticles, and the particle would be on the other side of the event horizon of a black hole and radiate out. The antiparticle would then be swallowed in the event horizon to the black hole, and by doing that, the black hole would lose mass, except that antiparticles don't have negative mass. They have positive mass. I don't know of any object that actually does have negative mass. It would be fascinating to know that, but I know of none.
Okay, I'm going to read something for you. It's Wikipedia. In theoretical physics, negative mass is the type of exotic matter whose mass is of opposite sign to the mass of normal matter. Example, -1 kilogram, so that would be -2 pounds. Such matter would violate one of or more energy conditions and show some strange properties such as the oppositely oriented acceleration for negative mass. It is used in certain speculative hypothetical technologies such as time travel to the past. And that was by Khanna Guriaf, 2019, January 28. Time travel is possible, but only if you have an object with infinite mass. But we don't know how much is the truth. Let me drop. It is used in certain construction of traversable artificial wormholes, which may also allow the time travel Krasnikov tubes, the Alcubierre drive, and potentially other faster than light rapid drives. Currently, the closest known real representative of such exotic matter is a region of negative pressure density produced by Casimir effect. So that's what Wikipedia says about it, and then it goes forth.
AC2GS. Well, the problem is, I mean, it kind of says similar to what I really said. It's not real. It's a theoretical construct that is interesting, and so people play with it. But there is no proof of any of it. It's sort of the same thing as instead of, say, me theorizing an object with a negative mass, what if I said it has an imaginary mass? What would you think about that?
Imaginary mass, I believe it's more accurate than negative mass, because for me negative mass is only a theoretical creature, and good question, got me there. And to Asian.
Okay, about 100 years ago, some very bright person plugged in an imaginary number to his equation and came up with the idea of something that almost everyone who's ever read any science fiction knows the name of. They're called tachyons. Tachyons are theoretical particles that have an imaginary mass. They have a lot of interesting characteristics based upon quantum mechanical equations when you plug absurd things like imaginary mass into them. A tachyon at rest will travel at the speed of light. Well, let's see, just above the speed of light, I think. As you at zero energy, it'll travel at infinite speeds. As you apply an infinite amount of energy, you can only slow it down to the speed of light. So they've been using that for science fiction purposes as faster than light communication and having people talk on tachyon-based transmissions. But it's all a theoretical construct for thinking of plugging imaginary numbers as opposed to minus mass numbers. It doesn't exist. And most physicists don't really think it exists. They just think it's a fascinating topic. Negative energy, negative mass, it does amazing things. It helps you with other theoretical constructs that don't make sense otherwise. As you mentioned, a wormhole will collapse in on itself. It's not a stable structure. And also, it will have a diameter of, I think, one Planck length. At one point, which means nothing can go through it because a Planck length is shorter than any fundamental particle known to man. So that's the problem with theoretical physicists. They like to daydream occasionally.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Further down, we have a specification. One is in cosmology and in general relativity. It's the second one. And in cosmology, it says that in December 2018, astrophysicist James Furness from Oxford University proposed dark fluid theory related in part to notions of gravitationally repulsive negative masses presented earlier by Albert Einstein that may help better understand in a testable manner the considerable amount of unknown dark matter and dark energy in the cosmos, exactly what you said. But then in general relativity, they say that negative mass is any region of space in which, for some observers, the mass density is measured to be negative. This could occur due to a region of space in which the stress component of Einstein's stress energy tensor is larger in magnitude than the mass density. All of those are a violation of one or another variant of positive energy condition of Einstein's general theory of relativity. However, the positive energy condition is not a required condition for the mathematical consistency of the theory. Thank you.
Okay, I mean, the bottom line is that physics is built from equations. Just because you can plug a number in to an equation and get an answer doesn't necessarily mean it's a valid answer for a valid thing. It's kind of like the old computer term, garbage in, garbage out. If you put in negative energies, if you put in negative masses, if you put in imaginary numbers for energy and mass, you get interesting results, but they don't really make a heck of a lot of sense, and you can't experimentally demonstrate any of them. So it becomes a bit of playing with equations. The equations are not the laws of physics. The equations are our best model of the nature of the universe, a simulation, if you will. And over time, we fine-tune the equations and the models to be closer and closer to the real universe. You know, classical physics was an approximation. Relativity and quantum mechanics may or may not be just a much better approximation to what goes on. We're still kind of stuck fundamentally in quantum mechanics with wave-particle duality, which some people kind of like to discuss as these things are waves and are particles, or sometimes they're waves, sometimes they're particles. Whereas as far as I can figure out, what it really amounts to is they're neither. They're something that we just aren't able to wrap our brains around, that in some cases will act as particles and other times will act as waves. Some might suggest that everything is just an excitation in a series of fields that are within all of space-time. You excite an electron field, you get something that looks like a point charge that we call an electron. It's not a particle. It's just an excitation of a field, whatever the heck that means. But, you know, I can go on and on, unfortunately, with that. But that's, you know, you have to kind of understand where physics kind of goes blue sky on you.
One more interesting thing, gravitational interaction with antimatter. The overwhelming consensus among physicists is that antimatter has positive, antimatter, has positive mass and should be affected by gravity just like a normal matter. A direct experiment of neutral anti-hydrogen have not been sensitive enough to detect any difference between the gravitational interaction of antimatter compared to normal matter. But bubble chamber experiments provide further evidence that antiparticles have the same inertial mass as their normal counterparts. And to exchange.
Yes, I think I mentioned that earlier. Despite what Stephen Hawking said about Hawking's radiation, antiparticles falling into a black hole will not decrease the mass of the black hole. Unfortunately, the actual reason for how Hawking's radiation works is not simple enough to write in a general interest book. Trying to read the real explanation would give too many people headaches and probably kill a lot of sales. So he decided to kind of fib, much to the annoyance of physicists. It's a brilliant work in reality. It's the closest we've come to a concept of quantum gravity. We've been trying to figure out how to relate quantum mechanics to gravity and failed miserably in Hawking's radiation and his calculations. He brings up a special case of quantum gravity that's actually solvable that explains the Hawking radiation. Pretty much, we mentioned earlier, black hole radiation. Black holes have a temperature. They have a very low temperature. And the bigger the black hole, the colder it is. But it's basically radiating black body radiation according to its mass. But for some odd reason, he decided to go with this fairy tale about antimatter having anti-mass.
In the course of your explanation, you mentioned mathematics and the way that physicists are trying to explain certain phenomena. And Schrodinger equation is one of the examples for it. For Egan states of Schrodinger equation, the wave function is wave-like, whether the particle energy is greater than the local potential and exponential like evanescent, whether it is less. Naively, this would imply kinetic energy is negative in evanescence regions to cancel the local potential. However, the kinetic energy is an operator in quantum mechanics, and its expectation value is always positive, assuming that with the expectation value of potential energy to yield to energy even value. If I said it properly. Yeah, but anyhow, now we have an example of some form of very much exotic problem. And to exchange.
I'm not sure if it's an exotic problem. Schrodinger's equation is an intriguing thing. I took a course It was a graduate level course on basically calculating the solution to Schrodinger's equation for hydrogen, which is, of course, the simplest configuration. The trick of Schrodinger's equation and of wave equations in general is that if you square the wave equation, you get a probability value for the objects that you're calculating. So if you plug in a single hydrogen with an electron, you can discern the shape of the electron cloud. That's what first gave us the dimensions and configuration of the s orbitals and the p orbitals and the d orbitals and the f orbitals of a single hydrogen electron getting pushed up to higher and higher levels. So it's an interesting equation, has a lot of things going on. It is ridiculously difficult to solve for anything but very simple atoms, and so most of our understanding is based on the very simplest of atoms.
Well, I use the word exotic, but I probably didn't say more than that. Well, for the wave function of particles with zero rest mass such as photons, this means that any evanescence portion of the wave function would be associated with local negative mass energy. So the Schrodinger, however, I would say, the Schrodinger equation does not apply to massless particles. Instead of, there is another equation, Klein-Gordon equation, that is required to explain that. That's why I called it exotic.
Okay, usually when people use the term exotic, they mean unusual, but still possibly it exists. Something that's incredibly rare.
Okay, so I was to use the word uncommon. Yes, thank you very much for explanation of that. My English is still not perfect.
No problem, Wesley. You get your thoughts across very well.
Thank you very much.
Any other points you want to share, Wesley, or that was it for tonight?
I think I use my time to the most of public I believe I don't have more of easy subject and interesting to the public, so I rest my case.
Okay, that's fine, Wesley. I just wanted to make sure. I thank you for the opportunity. I tend to enjoy discussing relativity and quantum mechanics. I hope someone out there enjoys listening to it. I have no way of knowing how many people are interested and how many people either don't care or don't know what I'm talking about and think I'm making stuff up. So I thank you for the opportunity. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net, the place to go if you got any questions. We have some very smart participants out there listening, ready to offer their opinions and thoughts and experiences. And please, if you got any questions of a technical nature, or topics you want to hear discussed, or science in general, or even vague medical questions that aren't related to you or family members. We don't make diagnoses over the radio, but please avail yourself of this opportunity. Hit that push to talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, someone out there had a really noisy signal. I could not make out a single word. So if you can wiggle your antenna in a different direction or raise the gain or do something magical, please do.
PJ again?
Yes, Ed.
To TJE?
Yes, Ed, please. Continue.
In reference to this new drug that somehow will attack plaque, causing Alzheimer's, can plaque be picked up on a CAT scan or an MRI? Over.
No, unfortunately, it cannot, which is one of the many reasons why diagnostic tests are so problematic. I am assuming that you are alluding to a drug that recently passed the FDA?
NY2H?
Yes, Lou.
Isn't there a PET scan, amyloid binding PET scan they can do?
Yeah, there are somewhat esoteric tests. A routine CAT scan or such is not going to pick it up, but with proper binding materials using a PET scanner, it's possible. I don't know if it's considered a definitive diagnosis, though. It's more, I think, a research type of thing at this point. I could be wrong. It could have shifted from one to the other over the time. Anyway, Ed, are you alluding to the recent FDA approval of a drug for Alzheimer's?
Yes, correct, which evidently I don't know how they're going to know if it is doing anything, although they approved it rather over.
Yeah, there's a lot of turmoil based upon that approval. There are some recent studies that put into question the whole idea of plaque producing this disorder in the first place. So an anti-plaque medication is somewhat more questionable. And the studies were not really definitive as far as I can recall. So it was kind of a 50-50 split in the FDA, and they sort of grudgingly approved it. This has not been unusual in Alzheimer's medications or other therapeutics. There have been a lot of claims, but not much in the way of actual proof of benefit. So my guess, and I could be totally wrong, is that at some point or other, there's going to either be a black box or a red box or some little box saying that, the FDA has reevaluated it and is not quite sure that it might not be useful or something. But they're going to fudge things because this was not a simple resolution by just approving it. This is not going to sit quietly. There are people at the FDA who are going to make a lot of noise regarding it. So, it's problematic. There's unfortunately no good medication for Alzheimer's yet. I wish there was. It's a growing problem because of the aging of America and human beings in general. But so far, nothing that really strikes me as miraculous.
Just curiosity. Is a big problem with the aging population in this country, and we're all looking forward to something around the corner. Okay, I thought maybe it had more input. K2GJE, back to net.
I wish it did, Dad. We could use something to treat this condition. It cripples people in a terrible kind of way. There are some people who rely as part of their identity as people with keen cognitive skills, and Alzheimer's rips that away from you one layer at a time. So, you know, it's an awful way to go. So they will continue working. As I said, there are some studies that suggest that the plaque model is not quite accurate, so they will be looking for alternatives. And I hope one of these days they come up with something useful. I mean, you know, they cured the other problem with Viagra, so hopefully they could cure this much more serious one.
You have me laughing. Supposedly they were able to look at Agatha Christie's brain, which was full of plaque, and yet she seemed to be functioning 100% to the end, over.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. I mean, we've discussed it in the past. Correlation is not causation. Everyone who has died, for the most part, has lied in a bed at least within the past 24 hours before they passed away. So correlation would tell you that the beds kill people. They don't. I hope not. But yeah, things usually end up being more complicated than they first are thought to be. And so I think it's going to be the same thing with plaque. Plaque might end up to just be an incidental other finding of age in brains. So, again, it's up in the air. I wouldn't invest in any company that has a cure for Alzheimer's quite yet. Any other questions out there? This is AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net.
WB2BXO, Nicholas.
Yes, Frank.
Okay, about a year and a half ago, about the time of the beginning of the pandemic, Steve Ford, WBAIMY, on his ARL Eclectic Tech podcast, interviewed Ham, who was working on a clinical trial where he was using RF to break up the plaques. It worked in a small clinical trial, and I believe at the time his group was looking for funding to do a larger clinical trial. I don't know what happened with that one. Go ahead.
Yeah, we discussed it actually here on the Technical Net. I did a story on it. I'm not sure if QST did a little. I think they did a little short article in QST. As far as I'm aware, they have never gone on to larger trials. Again, I'm not terribly optimistic. I'm glad that no one suggested that RF causes Alzheimer's. It just seems too gratuitous that RF destroys Alzheimer's. When the solution seems relatively simple, either you're very, very lucky or it's not the correct solution. So I was never a big fan of this theory. People have sort of done this with a lot of ailments. They either shield you with some special metal, or they expose you to some frequency of RF, diathermy, what have you. They're all dubious as far as I'm aware, but I haven't heard any further research done. My assumption was it kind of got stuck at that point and never got unstuck.
Okay, yeah, that's disappointing. It sounded promising from what they've done on this podcast, but then I've noticed the ARL picked up information that, you know, for was publicizing something. I noticed that recently on things that might not always prove out. But it was an interesting story at the time. And a bit later, I did finally read the UAP report. So I can come back a bit later and talk about that. Go ahead.
Okay. We can do it now. We're open and free. Paul is listening as we talk, so feel free.
Okay, very good. I didn't really want to disrupt the flow of the net here. I did read through this thing. You kind of mentioned last night that, hey, it's only a 9-page report. Why not read it? I went through it right after the text message. Also spoke about it with somebody I know at aerospace contractor. And a couple of interesting things about it is, first of all, the person I spoke to at an aerospace contractor called it a public-facing, toned-down summary of a much longer confidential or classified report. And that may well be accurate, though what the report is called is a preliminary report or a larger report. Now, that's interesting also, because what my reading of the thing is that what they want to do for a more detailed report is use an AI-enabled database to analyze their data and then do a new report. And what that seems to say to me is they're looking to give out a couple of $1 million to a contractor to build this database. Which to me does not really sound like it needs AI, but then the report has no level of detail, so I don't know. The other thing that occurred to me is, except for the 143 of 144 reports not being explained, they don't break it out any further in the five, what numbers may fit with what level of confidence into the five categories. And that may be something they have that they're not getting more detailed on publicly. Go ahead.
Okay. The point of bureaucracies is not ultimately to do much more than to maintain bureaucracies. So I'm not at all amazed that they've figured out a better way of spending more money. AI is one of those wonderful terms that everyone has anything to do with computers is throwing out. Especially a lot of graphics and face modeling and face recognition uses AI as a term all over the damn place. So it's no surprise to me that they would set it up with something and call it AI. I don't know exactly what that really ultimately does. I mean, what is it going to do? Google searches for flying objects? There's a lot of nonsense available there. So you have to kind of curate your source of information for the AI. I don't know. It strikes me as just some junior guy trying to come up with an excuse to keep funding his little pet program. I don't know. I didn't really get much out of it. I hope they don't throw good money after bad, but they probably will.
Well, all right. I'm glad my view on it isn't totally off the wall anyway. That's probably a very good analysis. Some junior guy looking to fund his pet program. And Marco Rubio is no doubt more than glad to fund some Florida aerospace or AI tech contractor to do it. WD2BXO, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a shame that we're spending our time with this on a federal level. I'm sure these guys have better things to do with their time. You got to keep in mind that every so often government offices go a little bit insane. There's a great book that I read, and it was made into a movie, The Men That Stare at Goats, that was about some department in the armed forces that was dedicated to things like extrasensory perception and telepathy and other nonsensical things. So you know, you'll always find a kind of middle or low-level bureaucrat, be it in the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, or the federal government, who, you know, who reads too many comic books, who decides to waste government funds on nonsense.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I kind of understand. I used to be, years ago, I was one of those low-level bureaucrats that was not called the Government Accountability Office. I wrote the drafts of these reports, so, you know, I kind of like to look at them and kind of reverse engineer them and try to figure out what's really going on. Back to that, WB2BX.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I sort of have done that in the past as well and come to some conclusions that sometimes the armed forces is toying with some technology, not alien, that they don't particularly want us to know about, and so they kind of throw us this UFO chaff to just distract and confuse us, and then they go back to their skunk works and such. But, you know, I guess they feel that they have to do it. Now, while you were transmitting, someone else kind of transmitted over you for a little bit, but if someone else out there wanted to transmit, please, what's your call sign and your first name? Okay, maybe I imagined that interruption, but... Nevertheless, once again, this is AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. If you have any questions, technical, scientific, even generalized medical, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and call sign. Okay, so I guess we'll bring back Science Talk articles. I have a few of them to share with you, and if you'd like to discuss them, that's certainly possible. First one is that Walmart is rolling out a cheaper form of insulin. Insulin is expensive, really expensive. You know, it costs hundreds of dollars per vial. Expensive enough that some diabetes patients can't afford their monthly dose. And now Walmart, of all people, is stepping up to make the drug a bit more affordable. The retailer announced this past Tuesday that it would be rolling out a budget version of analog insulin under its Rely-On label to adults and children with prescriptions for the drug. Per Walmart's announcement, these private label insulin vials will be available at approximately $73 each, and pre-filled FlexPen needles will go for $86 each at any Walmart pharmacy starting this week, with a wider rollout to Sam's Club pharmacies planned for mid-July. Considering how vials can cost anywhere from between $150 to nearly $400 a pop, this could provide some relief for Americans. Up until now, Walmart actually offered an even more budget-friendly insulin under the Rely-On label for about $25 a vial, but this cheaper version was based on an older, less effective insulin formula that garnered a fair share of criticism from doctors and diabetes advocates. More recent formulas, the so-called insulin analogs, like Walmart's new product, are more effective at preventing dangerous blood sugar swings among those with type 1 diabetes in particular. Meanwhile, the number of people across the U.S. with both forms of disease will only continue to skyrocket. While there are slightly more than 34 million adults living with the disease across the country today, some researchers theorize that the numbers could jump to more than 41 million by the time 2030 rolls around. And as those numbers keep climbing, so does the price of insulin these people need to take to manage their disease. Recent numbers from the Healthcare Cost Institute point out that the annual cost of insulin for people managing type 1 diabetes in the United States have nearly doubled from $2,900 in 2012 to $5,700 in 2016. Meanwhile, lawmakers on both sides have grilled insulin manufacturers over these sky-high prices, but have done virtually nothing else to help. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
And related to that, I'm on a new computer, and I don't have my favorites. And I'm bringing up Roy.AC2GS, but I keep going over to the King Park website. What am I doing wrong? I gotta put your favorite in this new computer.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I typed in roy.ac2gs.com, and I got Roy's link. So I'm not quite sure. Are you sure you're typing everything right? I assume you are, because, otherwise I don't know how you'd get to the front page of Kings County. But that's the website that is generously allowing me to kind of add my little pages to it.
Okay. A couple of years ago, I remember Dick doing the same thing. He got caught into the same problem. He kept going to the King's Park. Okay, let me do it again. Okay. Yeah, that's odd. You know, I got it back. I got that same crazy advertisement that keeps popping up. It popped up on both websites with the soldering gun. I don't know. They like your website. But, yeah, okay. I'm putting this back into favorites. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, that's no problem. That's a pop-up to advertise my other TechNet, I think. I have two TechNets. I have this one every Sunday night, and on the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month at 9 o'clock on KC2RC, I do another technical net.
Yeah, I'm well aware. I can't reach that repeater. I've tried.
Yeah, it's a little Brooklyn-based repeater. You know, we don't have any other links beyond our local area. But we do actually, just as I stream this technical net, I stream that technical net. So I'm just trying to send it off to as many people as humanly possible.
Okay, very good. I'm looking at the website now. The CRISPR deal, maybe the CRISPR deal will help with the Alzheimer's situation. I remember I'm talking about that on 60 Minutes. That would be good. That's different than the mRNA that they've been talking about. CRISPR's different. Between the two of them, what they do. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, messenger RNA is an interesting idea. It does not... It's less dangerous in some terms because a lot of people are very frightened of having their DNA screwed around with. A lot of false complaints was that the messenger RNA was going to rewrite everyone's genetics, which it doesn't. It doesn't affect your DNA in your nucleus at all. But CRISPR would. CRISPR is a technique to rewrite segments of your genetic sequences in your nucleus as you just sit around. So depending upon the finesse demonstrated with the ability of this to localize a specific gene and act on it in a beneficial way, could be miraculous or could be ridiculously dangerous down the road. I mean, people talk about GMOs. With this stuff, you could sort of probably do all kinds of foolish things with people's bodies.
Okay. One step forward, two steps back.
Well, you know, like I always say, all these things are just tools. The same as a hammer. You can build a house with a hammer. You could also knock a hole in your neighbor's head with the hammer. So It's up to the owner of the hammer to decide if he's going to be wise or foolish, smart, silly, or venal. That's the human problem. Sometimes we're smarter than we are wise.
Okay, very good. I see you got a couple of vaccine stories up there, too, as well. All right, I'll be listening. WS2N.
Okay. Any other questions or comments before I move on to the next story? Very well. The arrival of the Delta variant, the recently emerged strain of the coronavirus, thought to be the most transmissible yet, in the U.S. is understandably unnerving scientists and the public alike. But how worried should you exactly be about Delta, especially if you're fully vaccinated already? Delta, also known as B.1.617.2, was first discovered in India last October. Evidence, largely from the United Kingdom and India, suggested that it's noticeably more likely to spread from one person to another than the Alpha variant, also known as B.1.1.7, that used to be called the UK variant, was already more transmissible than the original lineage of the virus that first spread around the world. Estimates vary, but Delta may be about 40% more transmissible than Alpha and up to twice as transmissible as the classic original coronavirus. Alpha quickly established itself as the dominant strain in many countries, including the United States earlier this year, and now Delta has done the same in at least the United Kingdom and India. In the United States, about 20% of new cases are now thought to be caused by Delta, and within the next month or so, it's almost certain to be the new dominant strain. At this point, it's not clear if Delta is simply more transmissible than past strains, or if it's also more likely to cause illness and death in an individual person. But even if it were only more contagious, scientists are rightly worried about its potential to spread faster and wider than past outbreaks of the pandemic. It's already thought to have fueled the largest and deadliest peak in India, which has reported almost 400,000 deaths total. In truth, likely a major underestimate. Some have made it as high as a million people dead in India due to this. It also seems to be behind the renewed waves of illnesses ongoing in Africa. Let me drop for a sec. Most of these countries still have low to non-existent vaccination rates, but Delta has also been making a splash in highly vaccinated countries like the United Kingdom and Israel. In the United Kingdom, Delta has clearly been responsible for a surge of reported cases in the last month or so, and in Israel, an increase of cases linked to Delta prompted the government to reinstate rules in indoor mask wearing last week, days after it had lifted them. Over the weekend, the World Health Organization similarly called for fully vaccinated people to continue wearing masks in light of Delta. All of this is to say that Delta is the real deal, a more dangerous version of the already highly contagious disease that has killed millions in the past year. It's not accurate to say that vaccinated people have absolutely nothing to fear from Delta, but thankfully the risks appear to remain relatively low. The United Kingdom's surveillance of the virus, likely some of the best in the world today, has not only charted Delta's emergence in the country, but also provided clear data on the risk it poses to people fully vaccinated with Pfizer mRNA vaccine or the AstraZeneca vaccine. The data has suggested that the first dose of either vaccine doesn't provide as much protection against illness from Delta as it did against other strains, a sign that the variant contains some mutations that make it look a bit different to an immune system trained against the classic version of the virus. But this protection is only slightly lower in people fully vaccinated with two dosages. And most importantly, both vaccines continue to offer highly effective protection against hospitalizations and death from Delta, upwards of 90% effectiveness. Let me drop again. This is borne out by national-level data, too. Even as cases have significantly climbed back up in recent weeks, hospitalizations have only slightly increased, while deaths haven't at all. In Israel, which has the highest fully vaccinated rate in the world at almost 60%, cases have jumped a bit, but not deaths and hospitalization. A more open question concerns the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which only 12 million Americans have taken. Right now, there's simply no direct data on how efficacy may change with Delta, but other evidence from past variants like Alpha suggests that Delta should, at worst, modestly lower your level of protection from any illness. But protection from more serious illness should remain high with the J&J vaccine. That said, some experts are speculating that a booster shot like the mRNA vaccine could be available for those with only J&J shots. Let me drop for a sec. Delta, like Alpha before it, does represent a more fit upgrade to the original strain of the coronavirus. But novelty has always been the greatest strength of SARS-CoV-2, and once someone had exposure to it through vaccination or past infection, the body's immune system has its own bag of tricks to counteract the now familiar germ. Like viruses, for instance, our immune system can produce slightly mutated versions of antibodies that try to anticipate how it's likely to evolve. This adaptive means that it's not easy for a virus to completely fool a functioning immune system that's seen some from past forms of it. Sure, the coronavirus may eventually evolve into a substantially form that it will invade our immunity, but Delta doesn't seem to accomplish that goal. Based on all the information to date, researchers in India have recently warned about Delta Plus, a version said to carry an added mutation that may aid in immunity escape, but there's no conclusive evidence that either right now. New research just published recently, in fact, suggests that the vaccine provides immunity from the mRNA vaccine has the potential to last for at least a few more years. Let me drop for a sec. Unfortunately, in the United States, there are still areas of the country where vaccination rates are far lower than the national level, which is 63% of eligible people have at least one dose. Immunocompromised people who have been vaccinated but don't create as robust a response as others may also be at higher risk for the illness, and there are millions of kids under 12 who simply don't have access to the vaccination right now. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next story. A study looking at the impact of COVID-19 vaccinations, condemned by other scientists as seriously flawed and irresponsible, has now sparked a mutiny of sorts. This past week, several well-respected researchers have resigned from their involvement in a journal that published that paper, which argued that vaccines were killing almost as many people as they were saving from the pandemic. Recently, the paper was retracted. The study, titled "The Safety of COVID-19 Vaccinations, We Should Rethink the Policy," was published on June 24th in the journal Vaccine and was authored by a Harold Wallach, Rainer J. Clement, and Walter Akima. Citing several sources of data, the authors argued that COVID-19 vaccinations were more dangerous than commonly believed and that the benefits of inoculation only barely outweighed the risk caused by COVID-19. Most egregiously, they claim that for every three deaths prevented by the vaccination, we have to accept two inflicted by the vaccination. The paper was uncritically shared by some on the social media at first, including members of an anti-vaccination movement, but it was quickly criticized by many other scientists for its false assumptions, bad math, and outright misinformation. One of the main pieces of evidence that the authors presented to support their claim that the COVID-19 shots were deadly, for instance, came from the Netherlands' adverse event reporting system for their vaccines. But these systems are designed to record any health incident, including death, that occurs after a person received a new drug or a vaccine. They don't demonstrate that the incident occurred due to the drug. After all, a person may die for any number of unrelated reasons after receiving a vaccine, but instead are meant to flag possible signals of undiscovered side effects that could be linked to a new drug or vaccine, signals that then have to be studied further before any judgment can be made. It wasn't long before scientists associated with the journal Vaccine began to protest the study's publication. Within days, prominent scientists such as Katie Ewer, a member of the Oxford University team who helped create their now widely used COVID-19 vaccine, resigned from the journal's editorial board. A day after her resignation, the journal placed an expression of concern on the paper meant to alert people of many criticisms it had received and announced it would investigate the matter. The announcement didn't seem to stop the bleeding, though. At last count, according to the publication Science, at least six scientists in total have resigned from positions as associates or section editors with the journal. Let me drop for a sec. Finally, just today, Vaccine's remaining editor came back with their verdict, announcing that the paper would be retracted. In their notice, they pointed to several errors that fundamentally affect the interpretation of the findings, including the misrepresentation of the Netherlands vaccine safety data. The editors also noted that the authors were asked to respond to criticism made of their paper, but were not able to do so satisfactorily. The paper was then retracted under their protest. Even with this decision, some scientists have questioned how the paper got through the peer review process in the first place. Two of the three reviewers were anonymous, and none brought up any issues that resulted in retraction. The current fiasco isn't the only one to involve the MDPI, the publishers of Vaccine, and many other open-access journals. In its past, some scientists have accused the MDPI of being predatory publisher, more danger about the quantity than the quality of the research it publishes, criticisms that were still made this year before the latest retracted paper. Let me drop for a sec. We have established procedures for handling all complaints about published papers, which were followed. Damaris Critchlow, head of the publication ethics at MDPI, told reporters the editor-in-chief and the journal conducted an investigation of the scientific concerns raised, ultimately resulting in article retraction. Our editor-in-chief, editorial board, and journal treated the investigation with the utmost priority. We are in the process of consulting the editor-in-chief and the editorial board to establish further ways to support the academic editors who are responsible for manuscript acceptance decisions and for assessing the quality of the peer-reviewed report. This debacle shouldn't take away from the importance of confirming vaccine safety, though. We need to verify the data collected from clinical trials of any new medicine once it's released to the public, even in the midst of pandemic. But caution should be warranted if someone starts making extraordinary claims about safety or lack thereof, especially if those claims are based on adverse event reporting systems. Oftentimes, adverse events aren't related to the treatment at all, and it's only when the risk of a particular event is plausible and higher than it would be in the general population that scientists begin to suspect the connection between the event and the drug. This has happened a few times with COVID-19 vaccines, such as the now established link between certain types of blood clots and adenovirus-based vaccines like the AstraZeneca Oxford shots. So far, all the risks associated with vaccinations are either thought to be mild, short-lasting, or rare and manageable, and are clearly outweighed by the benefits they provide in preventing COVID-19, a disease that, remember, has killed at least 4 million people worldwide in a year and a half. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
B2BXO with a question.
Yes, Frank.
For those of us who aren't involved in academia, what is the difference between an open access journal and other kinds of peer-reviewed academic journals? Go ahead.
I think the guidelines to access to it are looser than a closed system of a very well-structured group of people who maintain the doorway for the magazines. Some of the most important journals out there are locked down with a group of people that you have to go through in order to get things done. I think this is a much more loosey-goosey publication system where, you know, as they mentioned, two of the three people who made the decision